This podcast contains some very open conversations about parenthood and mental health, so there may be some content that listeners might find triggering or upsetting. Please listen at your own discretion, and for help or support, look at the episode description for resources. And please do. Asking for help was the best thing I ever did. I'm Laura Dockrell, and this is Zombie Mum, a podcast that aims to normalise the conversation surrounding mental health and parenthood, hearing voices from the perspective of both parents and children for some empathetic, compassionate, heartbreaking, heartwarming, real talk. Bryony Kimmings is an acclaimed performance artist. Her work is investigative, challenging and inquisitive. Almost like a documentary maker, she digs deep like a forensic scientist. She is detailed, she is thorough, she doesn't miss a trick. But then she seems to parade her findings like a musical. Her work is usually dressed as a Trojan horse of some kind, sugar-coated, dusted in frosting, glitter and sequins, smeared in red lipstick, shoved in fishnets, pom-poms and a wig, and then it's got you. But do not be fooled, for the work is gut-punching, heart-twistingly raw, celebratory, emotive, full of grit, and it is funny, laugh-out-loud funny, but painful too. I've seen most of Bryony's work. She is a great inspiration of mine. But after the birth of her little boy Frank, the lines between fact and fiction became blurred for the storyteller and artist when Bryony was faced with her greatest challenge of all, herself. Bryony had experienced a healthy pregnancy, had an established career behind her, was in a solid, loving relationship with partner Tim when the couple rented an idyllic cottage to set up their beautiful, blissful family life together. But life, as it does, had other ideas. Frank was diagnosed with a rare neurological condition, and Bryony began to mentally unravel. Bryony, being Bryony, didn't just survive, she thrived. And when I was just months recovering myself, I was fortunate enough to see Bryony's astounding latest piece of work. The stage show, I'm a Phoenix Bitch, in which Bryony bears all, showing literal, physical, hysterical strength, a wild tenacity, the boundless love for a child, the ferocious, unapologetic, unconditional force of a parent. You see, there is a grief of some kind when a baby is born, a desperation to want to get back to or cling to who you once were or the life you once had before you were a braless mule carrying baby shit around. When I think back to Bryony's show, how unwell I was when I saw it, clutching Hugo's hand, trembling in the pews, I'm pretty sure I saw Bryony Kimmings die on stage that day, only to resurrect herself. From one zombie to another, the formidable, the incredible Bryony Kimmings. Hi, Bryony. Thank you for coming and doing this. So I first met you through the lovely John Osborne, the poet, who dragged me along to the Soho Theatre saying, you've got to see this girl, you've got to see her show. And it was 7 Day Drunk at the Soho Theatre, which was a performance piece you exploring the behaviours and the links, parallels between artists and their work and alcohol. And I was just like, blown away.
Can't believe also, you saw 7 Day. I remember meeting you and me being like, you was, had these parrot earrings and this like really brightly coloured clothes. And I was like, oh, who is this little ray of light? You came right up into my face and oh my God. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I really like her.
I'd wondered if we could just take it right back. How was your pregnancy? Can we start with that?
Oh, we're starting there, are we?
Yes, please.
Pregnancy. I mean, I chose to get pregnant, so that's always a slightly different experience, perhaps. So I was ecstatic, if a little anxious. I toured all the way through my pregnancy. I was in Australia doing, we were touring Fake It Till You Make It, Tim and I, touring into Edinburgh and Brisbane and all over the shop, and then a big long run at Soho when I was 8 months pregnant. It was a stressful time. I think if I ever did it again, which I don't think I will, I'd just chill the hell out. I was like, I must do all the things. I'm very efficient. I can be on stage when I'm pregnant. And it's like, dude, your head was already starting to slip away from you and you should have just sat down. Tim and I had trouble through pregnancy. We had trouble touring and we were arguing a lot and it was very stressful. Like, I think I should have slowed down and just been pregnant. I think that should be a job, being pregnant.
Yes, I agree with that. And I love so much of what you've said there, that kind of need to still be working and active and creating as well. Because, you know, I remember thinking Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein when she was pregnant. Like, she was so productive. I mean, she wrote Frankenstein when she was pregnant. Yeah.
She was going through pure psychosis.
But I totally get that. And then also that thing, I mean, did that come up, you know, that stressful pregnancy? Because people kept asking me that after I was ill. Did you have a stressful pregnancy? And you've said there you felt yourself almost slipping away there. Did you relate the two and connect that?
I think that what happened was, one, I had a child quite late, so you start getting called a geriatric, which I think triggered something in me that I didn't notice, but it was a sort of a panic and worry that I was going to lose him or not have him. And then I think also I'd established myself as an artist and been very proud of my independent career. And then it was this sort of impending doom of not knowing who I was going to be afterwards. I sort of buried it in my cells and I was like, it's going to just go away. And then I think if you, particularly if you have a psychotic episode, anything that you've sort of thought in a fleeting moment, it sort of buries itself into your brain tissue, that one anxiety or that one thought. So yeah, I think subconsciously things were happening.
Yeah, there's like a ball of anxiety, but then there's this like other little secret anxiety you're talking about that kind of switches and dances between other things.
Ooh,
that wraps around your brain, doesn't it? And it can be anything. You could read the back of a box of cereal and it could say, hey, are you feeling kind of crunchy today? And your brain, you'll go, great, maybe I'm crunchy. God, maybe I'm crisp. Maybe I'm a crisp now.
It still happens to me. Like, it's not, I mean, I'd say that, you know, I'm a recovered madwoman, but I think it trips a switch in you. I go out into the garden to smoke because I'm a dreadful smoker. And every time I go out into the garden, I get the worst anxiety and I come back in and I'm like a maniac. And it's like, you know, my main vision was spiders. So it's like, it's spiders again. It's like, why am I doing this? I allow myself to go outside, look at a web, get freaked out, come back in and be highly anxious for like 15 minutes.
Do you look for the web? Are you looking
totally
for the web?
Like, yeah. Absolutely.
Because I read lots of books in my recovery and one of the books, I love it. I mean, Dr. Claire Weeks's book, Self-Help for Your Nerves, which absolutely changed my life, that book. But she says, not about webs specifically, but she'll say, you'll be tempted, you know, like sort of like a tongue in an ulcer to shove it, you know, and go, does it still hurt? Can I still, if I search for it, can I still arouse it? Like how you're doing, you know, you're like, can I see a spider web? And is that self-harm or are you trying to see if you can not go there, you know? Have you still got the power of going there or not? It's interesting, isn't it?
It is. I think it's a compulsion. Personally, I think I get stuck into the negative so much. Like, I realise that I sort of seek out negative things, shameful things, because they sort of corroborate a feeling that I have about myself that's from a very young age. You know, I do quite transactional analysis-based therapy with my therapist, which is all about child-learned behaviours. So it wouldn't be odd in my kind of script, is what we call it, the script of you, that I would go outside and sort of search for webs, you know.
That is deep. Is it actual spiders?
It's about being infested. Some people see it as insects under their skin and they claw at their skin to try and get the infestation out. And there's also a type which is that your house is infested. It doesn't have to be spiders. It can be any insect. And it's about, I suppose it's about control and being overtaken. Maybe it's a metaphor for what's happening in your brain. But mine was spiders, and I've always had a terrible problem with spiders. And as a child, I dreamt a lot of spiders and attacking me and stuff. So it's that's my deep-seated fear, you know, to be attacked by spiders. So were they real? I think they were often triggered by, I lived in a tiny cottage, you know, very damp, tiny thatched cottage, which is riddled with spiders anyway, which is crazy. I hate spiders. Maybe one would appear of an evening, and then because it had appeared and I'd squashed it, I could hear all the other spiders in the house sort of saying, well, she squashed her, you know, she squashed her. She's a terrible person. We should all go and get her, you know. And then I would sort of hear their little feet. And so then I was afraid to go into different rooms and stuff. So I wouldn't say I had psychosis because I was very conscious. I didn't slip out of consciousness. Yeah, it felt like being infested with voices, but I was still very able to go, this is crazy, this is completely stupid, there's no spiders talking to you. But the house was silent on the top of a hill in the middle of nowhere, had a very sick baby upstairs, and it was like, what else was I going to fill my time with? I could have gone in down the Mad Men route. Mad Men, like watching the box set.
I know, I just went with that.
And then, like, instead I went down the, you know, the Mad Woman route.
Would you say you kind of chose then to go down the Mad Woman route?
Yeah, I think I'm an anxious person. When I think about my life, I think, oh God, I was always an anxious person, anxious child, anxious teenager, anxious in my 20s, but never identified as an anxious person, but had habitually sought out the sort of, oh, that's terrifying, oh my God, you know, like, I suppose in the Victorian times I would have been called someone who had a nervous disposition. And probably that's why I'm a performer, you know, because when I step out on stage, all of that noise in my head always goes off. A very meditative state for me. Even though I seem like a crazed woman, I'm like at home there because everything else switches off. And then I'll get off the stage and it'll be like, oh my God, I wonder if anyone thought it was amazing. Oh my God, what am I going to do? How do I get this makeup off? What's going to happen? Like, well, should I wash my hair tonight? What am I going to do? Should I go to the garage? And it's like, oh my God, shut up. So I think when something bad happened, it was like my go-to to worry. But because the chemical imbalance was so depleted, perhaps, or had been sort of mounting up, now they think I might have ADHD, so that might have had something to do with it. I think the go-to was panic.
You may have heard of the podcast Juicy Scoop. Wondered what it is? Why aren't you listening? Well, I'm its host, created it, been doing it for 7 years. I'm Heather McDonald of Juicy Scoop with Heather McDonald. Now, I could tell you why you should be listening to my show, but my listeners wanted to write the ad for me, and here are some of the things they said. Not your regular Juicy podcast. Catch up on all the juicy topics from Hollywood and pop culture to true crime and beyond. Heather McDonald's Juicy Scoop always has great guests, great laughs, and great gossip. It's a comedian's take on the hottest headlines. Juicy Scoop is the pop culture news you want to hear. No BS, no filter, no filler. Raw, real, and in the moment. Throw in the hilarity of amazing comedians that you will instantly be obsessed with, a juicy crime story, and a dash of normal life in LA moments, and you've got yourself an amazing week of Juicy Scoop. 2 episodes every week, every Tuesday and Thursday. It will never let you down.
Can we talk about your labour? Because you sent me a message and I'll always remember that. You said, I think you're really going to enjoy this. I really loved mine. And it was such a nice message to get.
I think it's really important that you hear those ones as well. When someone is pregnant that I know, I'm always trying to like just slightly subvert what you normally get, because it's sort of like, oh God, remember when my fanny fell out because I had a baby and my arsehole fell out? And it's like, oh my God, please don't tell me that. And people love doing it. So it's like, actually, I really enjoyed my birth. I was a bit nervous of the pain of it. And my mum was very unhelpful by sort of going, oh, I pushed mine out with a paracetamol. You know, and it's like, oh God, fuck off, lady. Yeah. So annoying. And so I did hypnobirthing because I think I was feeling a bit anxious. But I didn't want to make a birth plan. I was like, I'm not going to feel disappointed about this or negative about this. It was hard. I mean, it was painful in that way that birth is, which is a bit sort of different to being punched in the head repeatedly for no apparent reason. This is like pain to then get something that you sort of wanted. So I didn't have a birth plan, but I did know I wanted to try and have him in water. You know, I was really keen. I just sort of, the ideal would be to be in this, you know, the Beyonce room it was called, which is just amazing to me. And, you know, I chose my birth colour. It was sort of a little bit like all my hippie sort of beliefs are, which is a bit like, lol, you know, like crystals, sure, lol, but also totally. Like rub this crystal, put it in my bra, make sure it doesn't ever leave my side, just in case. Yeah, it was nice. Tim was a real champ, actually. His face was so lovely all the way through. He was just so mesmerised and proud. I could just see him being like, that's my girl, you know, go on, girl. Yeah, and he got stuck for a while, Frank, so it's very painful when he went back to back. The moment where he came out into the water, this Guinness-haired baby, this little monkey, and for a moment he just sort of floated there, which was really magical. And then the midwife was lovely. She sort of pushed him with her hand up onto my tummy, and then he sort of did that thing, you know, that thing that you see him programs where he sort of went nuzzle, nuzzle, nuzzle up my chest. And then he just sort of looked at me. The sad thing is that my brain went, I'm meant to be feeling something. I'm meant to be feeling something. I'm meant to be feeling something like that. And I was like, oh, why am I doing that? Like, I didn't think, oh, it's a baby, or wow. I just thought, yep, that was the result that I thought was going to happen. That's the obvious ending to this section of my life. But then they gave me this injection to get the placenta out, and they didn't really ask me. And I would have happily birthed the placenta out, and all of a sudden, that gorgeous, beautiful oxytocin shine that was in the room all went to shit, and I felt like the most anxious I've ever felt in my whole life, the most paranoid I've ever felt in my whole life. And then the doctor came in and said, you've torn yourself from arse to, you know, vag or whatever.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, have I? You know, I couldn't feel anything because it's all numb, isn't it? It's all stretched. And I was like, oh, no. And then sort of straight out of that bubble, they were like, right, down to surgery. And it was like, I hadn't even held him, and then you're gone. And it's that sort of thing where you think, this is medical intervention, it is fine, this because I could have bled to death, fine. But at the same time, these people are so used to birthing kids every day, that they forget that you just have just given birth.
It's another day at the office for them, but it's not for you.
Yeah. And I find that quite difficult because the birthing centre as well isn't medical intervention. The medical intervention comes when they have to call them. So you have all this sort of lovely talking about, oh, you know, this and that, and the Beyonce room, and Tim was playing the hypnobirthing music, and then all of a sudden this man comes in who wasn't invited and goes, I need to stick a needle in your back and you need to have... And then 10 minutes later, my legs are up and I can't feel them, and then I'm looking at my feet thinking, what is going on? And then this guy with this long needle and thread, like, sewing up my arsehole, and I was just like, oh, God. And then, even worse, Laura, I lay down in the recovery, and Tim had had him skin to skin, and we're a close family. I felt like that was good enough for Frank. You know, I never felt like, oh, I deprived him of anything. But this woman was putting her coat on. I was in the recovery area from surgery. And someone had obviously said to her, look, you need to go and get the colostrum out of this woman's breasts. Like, she's just had surgery. The baby probably needs a little bit of sustenance. She came over to me. She didn't even say a single word. She took my breast out of my gown, squeezed it, took a syringe of yellow colostrum out of my boob. Nothing had ever come out of my boobs before. I was absolutely gone.
It's terrifying.
And then pushed it into my son's mouth. And she said, there you go. And I was like, we were so shocked. It was like, what the hell was that? And all those little things, I mean, that's not a little thing, but all those little things imprint on your relationship with your baby. And I think, again, it went into the mind tank, you know? It went into the little cells, and it was like, I didn't breastfeed my baby the first thing that he ever tasted. You know, that paranoia came back later in a different form. I didn't give him what he needed, you know? Bigger and bigger that thought grew.
That, what you just described to me, is pure trauma. You're in pain. You get torn from your fanny to your bum hole. You're injected. Yeah. Your baby is then taken out of you. You've just met that, the shock, the paranoia, the anxiety. And then your baby is something grabbed out of your tits by a stranger and then force-fed that to your child. And you're just there thinking, with your legs, your feet up in the air.
I know. And also it's sort of like, it's not a big deal. Everyone does it and no one goes... Like, you just described it back to me and it's like, that sounds horrific. But it's like, oh yeah, that is what happened.
And then what happened? Frank got unwell, didn't he?
Well, the first 4 months he was fine. Although I don't know if that's true now. Now I keep thinking about him when he was really little. Was he fine, you know, or was he always... Because he'd just been diagnosed as having autism. And he was a lovely baby, really well-behaved, really just so... And when I look at photos of him now, I'm like, he is the ugliest thing I've ever seen in my whole life. Poor, my poor friends, I was going, look at this beauty. And they were just like, that is an ugly baby. I mean, he's beautiful now. But like, Jesus. You know, when you just have that... I mean, you don't, because you had a terrible time straight away. But you look at your kids and you're like, fuck, they're cute. And then other people... must just be like, they're gross. They are gross. Other, when other people say to me, like, oh, my kid, blah, 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 I think, I hate your kid. You know, not a lot of kids are nice. And everyone's like, my kid's the best. And you're like, your kid is a bastard. I hope none of my friends with kids are listening, because I mean all of your kids. I was quite depressed. I would call postnatal depression.
And did this come on immediately, would you say?
I had the baby blues, you know, like, I was in hospital for a week. Frank was... not well. He had a, you know, jaundice, not too bad. But my mum gave me this ridiculously strong arnica from her homeopath, and I passed like a, instead of like bleeding, just like bleeding a bit, I'd like stopped bleeding, then all of a sudden passed like an apple-shaped blood clot. And I think it had just been really efficient at kind of congealing all the blood. And then it was just like, oh, Jesus, I've just birthed a Braeburn apple. And the woman was like, that's a fucking blood clot. I was like, sure, it's not
that's
your twin.
A baseball of blood.
Yeah, it was really brutal. It looked like a beetroot, you know, like a pickled beetroot. Anyway, so I had to stay in. I was having a really lovely time. I was struggling to breastfeed. I find that very difficult. I didn't do it for very long. I was lonely and I didn't feel like I was coping. I didn't feel like I was good at it. Didn't really like Tim. I felt that he wasn't the partner I should have chosen. I think we both probably felt like that by this point. So yeah, it was just a bit of depression really. But I think that's so normal. I didn't know who I was. Like I kept looking in the mirror and being like, who am I? Like I'd dyed my hair brown because I'd not wanted to bleach my hair because I didn't want to hurt my baby, which is a lie anyway. And then I wasn't washing because I was like, I don't want to put any smells on myself that aren't my smell because he won't know who I am, you know. So I'm like, when I think of it now, there's some really strange behaviour going on there. And like, I mustn't, I had to be silent, you know, I had to be silent and just weird stuff. And then he got ill at 4 months old, started having seizures. I'd never seen anything like it. And I still, it haunts me to this day, the look on his face. You know, like you get those stress balls that have eyes that you can squeeze and then the eyes sort of slightly pop out. You know what I mean? Like yep, kids' toys yep, and you squeeze yep, them and the, totally. You see the water inside. It was like that. It was like almost like his eyes were just nearly popping out and then back again. It was so scary looking and so like a sci-fi film, like ghoulish, you know. You know, it lasted for a day or so and I was like, this isn't right. Like, he was making a little bit of noise when it happened and stuff. So we took him to the doctor and the doctor was like, he's having seizures, so we have to send him to the hospital. And I was like, this is seizure. I remember thinking, like, but a seizure is like a convulsion. She was like, no, no, no. A seizure is a specific thing that happens in your brain, a surge of electricity in the brain. And Tim and I were still thinking, oh, seizures, must have an allergic reaction to something. And then I remember MRI, then the one where they stick all the things to your head and they, and it, an EEG it's called. And I know now that normally they look like, you know, a bit like a heartbeat monitor, but with lots of different pens going up and down on a piece of graph paper and normal brain waves. They look like lots of individual lines of wavy lines. And Frank's was almost like, and I watched it, it was sort of almost just doing like a crazy sort of all over the place, like a scribble, like a child's scribble, and thinking to myself, the machine must be broken. And me saying to the woman, that doesn't look right. And her saying, I can't say anything because I'm not a doctor, because she was only doing the EEG. And I remember thinking, that is not good news. And then I remember saying to the guy who'd come in to tell us that he had West syndrome, and us just being like rabbits in headlights. I remember holding Tim's hand so tightly and just being like, this can't be real. And then me saying to him, okay, I get everything you're saying, but I just want to ask one really simple question. Is this really serious or not serious? And he looked at me dead in the eye and he was like, this is extremely serious. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, like, he's going to die. I think we just both were in shock for about 24 hours. I mean, it's the same with any parent who has an ill child. It is the most alien, traumatic, it's such grief. And I can't even imagine what it's like if to lose a child. But, you know, it is like somebody punching you in the throat, the heart and the head at the same time and then just continuously doing it and you having to just be like, okay, I'll just walk to my car whilst this person is punching me in the throat. I'll just try and sleep while this person, you know what I mean? It's so very strange. And that was that. It was then we lived in the world of the, you know, we lived in the kingdom of the sick for 6 months, longer than he would had been alive.
From the outside, you know, I remember hearing that you had had Frank and your and Tim's journey, you know, doing the show together and just getting all the accolades and plaudits that it completely earned and deserved and touring. And I get these messages from you like, we're in Australia now, blah, 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 like this. And then for your baby to be unwell, it's kind of that thing that happens like in the animal kingdom, I suppose, where this kind of thing of sorrow for everybody, it rippled, you know, everybody felt that for you.
Yeah.
But I had no idea to the level that you had suffered.
But then also you were living alone, weren't you, at the time in that cottage? How did that come about and what was that like?
Well, when Frank got ill, Tim and I had been arguing so much. We'd reached a bit of a plateau and I think we'd both gone like, okay, do we actually want to be together? I think we'd got to the point where we're like, yeah, we do. You know, everyone says don't split up in the first year, for God's sake. It's not real life. It will get better. And then Frank got ill and we started to argue again. And I think both of us were just like, no way can we do this at the same time. You know, like, we can't be arguing about towels and driving to hospital. So he moved to his mum's, which was, you know, a couple of villages along. It was horrible. And it was really brutal for both of us. But he obviously had his mum and I didn't have anybody. But also I was doing that thing of like, I'm absolutely fine. Like, I'd prefer to be, I did prefer to be on my own because I'd rather just get my head down. But, you know, you're talking about measuring probably 28 different doses of 4 different drugs each day. A child that's on steroids is like waking up every hour to give them milk, and them so angry, and so the personality changes very much on steroids, you know, like it does for anyone that's on roids. Like, it's totally makes you really mad. And so he'd gone from a still peaceful like seal pup to this sort of like a gremlin, you know. I started to see the house as something that it wasn't, you know, like I started to look at it like it was a haunted house, and what it looked like changed for me. It's like a lens dropped over it, and it was haunted and creepy and fairy tale-y, and it had been such a hopeful place, and then it suddenly the winter came and it felt so dark. This is the first thing I thought made me realise I was going a bit mad, was that I thought Frank was a changeling. Even the word changeling makes me feel anxious now. That someone had come in the front door when I was asleep and swapped him out. I mean, he looked different, he acted different. And then I started to feel like I didn't love him as much, you know. And I was like, oh God, this isn't my child. I'll feed it and I will look after it, but I won't give it as much love as my own. I will put all that love I have for Frank in a box until he comes back. And then I was sort of speaking to someone. She'd, you know, not far off had her own baby and her own trauma. And I remember sort of slightly describing that to her, and she was like, what do you mean? And I was like, well, you know, when they came and swapped him out. And I think she was a bit like, okay. And then she checked on me a lot actually after that. But I remember hearing her say sort of, oh, okay. I was like, oh, yeah, no, that's crazy. So because other people have been a bit like, are you all right? I sort of just went, I'm just going to shut the door now and not speak to anyone. Because I don't know quite what's going on, but I don't want anyone else to know. Aww. And then the spiders came, and then...
Do you remember the first time you saw the spider, or had you seen the spiders you spoke about in your childhood, or...?
I don't know, this is going to sound really crazy, but I think I have a bit of a sixth sense for spiders, because I can feel them before I see them, which is, it can't be real, but it could be, you know, who knows? I think the first time was, I'd seen 3 spiders in the bedroom, and I'd killed each of them, and then been like, they're all trying to take Frank away. They've come to take him away. And I remember staying up all night that night and being like, they're not having him. Like, no way are they having him. And I think that was the moment that the next morning I was like, that was crazy. But I still didn't go to the doctors.
There's something about you, isn't there, that's such a like streak, a trait, which is incredible, which is that you are a woman of your own power. Like, you are so strident and you're always on a crusade, whether it be your career or anything. And that is what I've always been like, wow, about. Like, that is so bloody cool how you just do it all on your own. And then actually realize the bravest thing a person can do is ask for help.
Yeah. Oh my God, totally. Totally. Like, I've got a new partner who's really great. And I've spent, you know, 5 years really being messed up about love after everything that happened, and really having terrible relationships, no offense, terrible men, and suddenly felt like I was out of the trauma and suddenly found this amazing guy. You know, I still find it very hard, but I can be like, I feel really anxious today, and I feel like I'm going to be a bit snappy, so I want to say to you that I'm feeling really anxious, and that, you know, I'm feeling a bit spidery, and, you know, whatever it is. And he'd go, okay, cool. And then, you know, every now and then he'd put his arm around me and say, you know, I really love you, you're brilliant, and don't forget that. And, you know, you're like, oh, this is what it's like to be open about your emotions. This would have been so much easier if I'd have just gone, I'm feeling very unwell. But for some reason, that's a sign of weakness in my brain, and that, you have to cope, you have to do it by yourself. I don't know, it was very unhealthy. The thing that's always served me really didn't serve me. And I've had to spend a long time unpicking that part of my personality, that I can't be seen to fail, that I can't be seen as weak. It's not healthy. And so I sent myself insane instead of feeling weak.
How did you end up going to ask for help in the end? Because I remember you saying that you literally crawled to the doctors. Is that right?
Yeah, I crawled to the doctors. It felt like dragging, you know, like, what's it called? Prostrating. I mean, depression. I've just had it for, I go through bouts, but I've just had a really, like, almost debilitating one. I've been in bed for a few days. And it's just teetering on the edge of being very unwell. Which is good. I know what to do and I've stopped it from being that. But it does feel like you're sort of wading through syrup. It's like, oh, let's get myself to the doctors. You know, really crawl. Even if you're just walking around, it feels like that.
Was that the first time you had gone to the doctors and said that you didn't feel well in yourself?
Yeah. I think I'd been at Tim's house dropping off Frank and I sort of collapsed on the floor crying and I remember him saying, you're not ill, get up. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I am really ill. I got to go to the doctors.
I just want to paint this image for listeners who haven't seen the show. In I'm a Phoenix Bitch at the start, you present yourself as this heightened, beautiful version of yourself with a wig and a glittery gold dress, like a showgirl. Mm-mm. And then you have this other character of yourself with a blunt, choppy fringe, lifting weights, being a powerhouse. And in the show, you need both of these characters to get through. After going through what you've gone through, are you either of these women?
I'm only really just getting to know myself, Laura. Like, I feel like a lot of my behaviours are defence mechanisms. And, you know, I have a very strong armour and I'm very conditioned. And I think I'm very different to what I think I am. I'm very home-centric. I'm very quiet. I'm very geeky. I'm just finding that I'm, yeah, neither of those ladies. I think we become different people as we grow up. You know, I've probably been all of those ladies. And I think I'm also a different person each time I'm in a different week of my period cycle. So I actually find it really confusing to think of who I am. It sort of spins me out. If you try to sort of think of who you are, decant yourself into a description. Yeah, I don't know who I am. Who knows?
I think I'm getting there. Talking about the therapy is so incredible because you never, this is really cliche. I'm so sorry. Why is this not on a mug in Clinton's? It probably is. But someone said to me not too long ago, you only fix the roof when it's raining. You never fix the roof when the sun is shining. Not about me, just as a line.
Yeah.
And it, for some reason, it just caught me because it was like a nice day and the leaves were on the floor or something. And I was like, that's really true. I am still thinking about you. When you said that crawl to the doctors, you're also crawling back to that person of yourself that you had before you had a baby, before you threw this life bomb into yourself and exploded and can't get back. And the grief is grieving of who you once were.
Yeah, you miss that person.
You can't access. You miss the time. You miss what she was into, what made her tick, how quick she could come back with comments, what she would order at a bar.
Yeah.
You can't find her anymore. You were your own rescue team.
Yeah. I always wanted to write something that was about a woman who gets into trouble and gets herself back out of it again, because that is, you know, it's not something that you see that often and not something that you hear about when you're a child. And I remember sitting in the cottage and thinking, where is he? What, you know, not even Tim really, but like, what's going to happen? Who's going to save me? And then being like, oh, shit, bitch. It's going to be me, yeah. And I think I say at the end, I'm going to be new Bryony now. I don't like her as much. She doesn't quite fit. She's all scarred and charred and she doesn't laugh half as much as she used to, but she's who I'll need when the flood comes again. And you can take old Bryony with you too. She'll always be there, showing you just how beautiful life was before the first trauma. And you think, oh my God, I was such a fool, you know. So emotional being a mother, isn't it? It's so emotional. It's like unbelievable.
Really,
yeah, it's amazing, but it's also very terrifying.
It's such a shame that you have to find out about being mentally unwell on your own. that you have to get there by yourself, that you have to find out when that roof is ripped open and the storm is gushing in, and that's how you got to find out. And that's what I was going to say to you. One of the questions I always get asked is, I'm not going to have a baby again because there's 50% chance of me getting my illness again, which is a whole other thing. I mean, it's a one of those Russian dolls where it's like a woman inside another woman inside another woman. It's like, because what's 50% chance of anybody getting ill ever anyway?
Yeah,
anyway, you can get ill from anything, you know. I've been asked before, you know, if I was to have another baby, would I want Jet to see me unwell? And that's the one thing that I'm like, absolutely not. My only saving thing that I've had is that he was so tiny. It was so bombastic and huge, my illness. It was all taken care of, and all these little carers had to scamper in and clean it all up before he even knew it had even happened, like little magic fairies. Obviously, the truth is dragging yourself out of hell, but you do have to do that. But I'm so grateful as a mum that I can now pass on and educate my son about mental health and illness, and know that he can keep the spiders at bay and not be scared of the spiders, and know that they're warning signs, alarms. Do you feel that having that experience has informed you as a mum? And will, I mean, I know Frank's had his own...
It's slightly different for me. I always find I'm in having a parallel universe mothering experience that only a few, select few stressed out special needs mums will understand. It's slightly different because I'm never going to probably sit down with him and talk about mental health. He's not that child, you know. But I have a stepchild, and of course I will always be brutally honest about things age appropriately. And with my nieces I am, and you know, with everybody I would encourage them to do that. But I think as a society we're becoming really good at that. I don't think our children will suffer like we suffered, because I just don't think it's possible. It's something just distinctly Victorian about it, which is, it's going to be over soon. As soon as someone says something, the world does change pretty quick, you know. I have faith that once a few whistleblowers go, hang on a minute, this is fucking ridiculous. I mean, how are we not talking about mothers and mental health? And like, how did we not see that drawing milk from my breast might have actually sent me completely loopy? So I think we have to have faith that the world does change. I'm a distinctly positive person trapped inside a negative person's body. So... I mean, of course, I parent very differently than I would have done. Not just because he has special needs, but because I have a depth of feeling and reserve that I think having fallen into the depths of despair gives you. If you're willing to face it and not just then go, oh, fucking hell, I'm glad I don't have to go back to being depressed again. That really didn't happen. Or, ooh, we don't talk about that. If you really go there and you interrogate it, then you become a sage for other people's use. And you can be that witch that goes, I've been there, I understand it, and it's time for me to impart this knowledge that I have gathered to you. But you'd hope at some point soon that is what you get given when you get pregnant. You know, you get given a nappy cake, but you also get given a handbook that someone passes you under the table that sort of says all the things that could possibly go wrong and how to solve them.
And a packet of antipsychotics.
Yeah, and some fags.
And what has Frank taught you?
God, how to love, how to, oh God, what a question, why did you ask me that question? Oh, what's he taught me? Oh, I can't think of the words. Frank has taught me how to love, yeah, how to love.
I'm crying.
I can't think of anything else. I don't know, it's so weird, it's like, I'm not religious, but I think he was a good child for me to be sent to me because I'm a good special needs mum. He's a wonderful person, and I think I deserved an autistic child because I would be one of the best people to give him a good life, you know. I'm so happy that he's my little boy, and I think we'll do great things together, you know, for neurodiversity and for him as a person.
That is beautiful.
Oh, I thought I'd get through this without shedding a tear.
I actually did hold back a lot what I thought I was going to do. Like, I Parmesan shaved my tears. I Parmesan shaved them because I was ready to full blow blocks of feta on you.
Parmesan shaved my tears.
Before we finish, I just want to say thank you, because I remember asking you if I should write this book or not. And I remember you saying, how old would he be and when it comes out? And I said, he'd be two. And you went, you'll be fine by then. And I just didn't believe you. I was just like, yeah, maybe other people get fine. Maybe you get fine, Bryony, but I'm not going to be fine. And I'm fine. In fact,
and you were?
I'm fine. Yeah, I'm better than fine. I've learned so much from this. You know, I feel actually plugged into the world now. Mm. I get it now.
I know. I don't think you would have had that if you had not had a traumatic time, darling. And sometimes these things are sent to make us better people and better mothers and better partners. And it's sad, but I do view it as the bumps in the road is what life is. The plateaus are like gifts, but the bumps are the things that make us who we are. And I think it's important to remember that there's value in those things. And if you listen to them, they'll teach you something. And if you try and hide them, they'll fuck you up again and again until they're just going, excuse me, will you fucking listen?
Thank you for giving me this time. And
oh, my pleasure.
Your real talk. I love it. Thank you.
If you have been affected by any of the themes in this programme, head to the episode description for resources and helplines. Zombie Mum was produced by Bea Duncan, with original music by Hugo White. It was mastered by Rob Fincham. The executive producer was Hannah Walker-Brown. This is a Broccoli production. Next week, I'm talking to Nikesh Shukla. Here's a sneak peek from our conversation.
I find this idea that parents don't see colour difficult because it ultimately means that parents just see everyone as white. You know, we have to push up against the defaultness of whiteness. In order for us to do that, parents need to see colour and they need to curate accordingly.